From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. This hour, we focus mainly on our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan as we prepare to mark the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. In Iraq, the official end of combat for U.S. troops comes as that country is still struggling to appoint an executive to lead the government. Meanwhile, will President Obama's troop surge in Afghanistan against al-Qaeda and the Taliban work as well as it did in Iraq? And a battle on the home front. General Petraeus warns that plans by a small Florida church to burn copies of the Quran could endanger our troops. Joining us today, political scientists Stefan Schmidt and Richard Mansbach of Iowa State University. Our discussion starts right after this news. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thank you for joining us over the noon hour. It's Politics Day here on The Exchange. In this hour, we focus mainly on the political implications of our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan as we prepare to mark the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. Also, new peace efforts for the Middle East, and we'll hopefully touch on the upcoming midterm elections as well as they fit into these other conversations. We'd like to have you join our conversation. What's on your political mind as we come up to the ninth anniversary of the attacks on 9/11 that this coming Saturday? My guests for this hour, two political scientists, political science professors at Iowa State University. We have Stefan Schmidt joining us along with Dick Mansbach from the studios of Iowa Public Radio in Ames. Professors, welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Thanks.
General Petraeus warns, starting off with this issue, it's all the headlines on all the major news. The General Petraeus warning that plans by a small Florida church to burn copies of the Quran on the 9/11 anniversary could endanger our troops. This, he says, is precisely the type of thing the Taliban uses to recruit and inspire its fighters. Despite condemnations from within and outside the U.S., the pastor of the Dove World Outreach Center insists his plans for the mass torching of the Quran would go ahead this Saturday. Protests in Muslim communities around the world have already begun in anticipation of the Quran burning. A protest placard in Jakarta, Indonesia, the world's largest Muslim-majority country, read, "If the Quran burning takes place, America has failed as a champion of democracy." We want to reach out to our listeners and ask, should the Florida church heed the advice of General Petraeus and so many others canceling its controversial Quran burning demonstration? What are your thoughts? 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Our email. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Let's turn first of all to Stefan Schmidt. What are your observations about this planned Quran burning demonstration and the uproar that it's caused?
I don't believe in book burning, whether it's the Quran or, you know, Mad Magazine. I think it's an expression of undemocratic sort of symbolism. So I'm generally opposed to it. The Nazis did it, and all authoritarian governments banned books and then burned them. So secondly, I think the good pastor or bad pastor, Terry Jones, just simply doesn't understand what freedom of expression really is. It's not unlimited. You know, if a passenger on an airplane starts yelling, "I have a bomb," that's not an expression of his freedom of speech in the United States. And we limit that freedom under certain circumstances when the public interest is threatened by it.
So you can't
yell fire in a
okay,
movie
but,
theater.
But to take that parallel a little further, so why isn't anybody stopping this preacher?
Well, once upon a time, I think it only took two people to sign a commitment to a lunatic asylum. I volunteer to be one right now on the behalf of the good pastor. Frankly, Stefan, don't you think that our legal wizards in Florida can find some charge, incitement to riot or something, to put him away for 72 hours?
People are spineless and cowardly and afraid of, especially when they're suppressing some sort of religious activity that's connected to religion. And the news media is as spineless as anyone else. They're tiptoeing around this. Nobody is saying that this is a great threat to the the United States symbolically as well as specifically in the places where Islamic groups are at war with us.
You know, the most remarkable thing of this whole event is that probably our greatest challenge in terms of foreign policy is weaning the moderate Muslim from his radical minority. This, of course, makes it almost impossible, creates an impossible situation for moderate Muslims. Mm-hmm. Absolutely impossible.
Secretary of State Clinton condemned this plan, Bernie, as many others in the government have, has expressed her hope that the media will not cover the event on Saturday as, quote, an act of patriotism. Can you imagine that happening?
No.
This is the era of the internet, so the pastor will have
YouTube.
1,000 little YouTube videos of it that people will shoot with their cell phones if the mainstream media doesn't do it.
Right. And the mainstream media will cover it.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Now we brought up the yelling of fire in a theater or something like that. Where is the line here? How can we make – don't you have to make a direct correlation between burning a Quran and the loss of life somewhere? And how do you do that in this case?
I don't think you can make that direct connection, but legally that's never been a barrier. I mean, literally nobody has ever had to show empirically that yelling fire in a theater would cause that. It's a logical issue, which most law is.
On the other hand, we did let Nazis march in Skokie, and, you know, we've had the Ku Klux Klan and other groups that, use the right to protest, to demonstrate, to express themselves. And that's, you know, in a way, one of the sort of strengths as well as weaknesses in this country.
Well, you know, my response, Stefan, to that is I have no problem if the ACLU wants to bring a case to court and get an injunction. That's fine. I still think it's absolutely compelling that that he not be permitted to do this.
But I think he'll chicken out. I think he's gotten
He was
enormous...
praying, wasn't he? He was praying. Last scene.
A lot of publicity. His little Dove World Outreach Center has gotten more publicity than he could ever buy. He's lost half his congregation, which I guess maybe he doesn't care because he'll attract two or three times as many who like what he's doing. Mm-hmm. And I don't think there is probably much mileage for him to actually go and do it in New York. And in fact, if I were him and I saw in the interview that CNN did, at least with him, that he had a loaded pistol sitting on the Bible next to him in his little office in Florida. So I think he's a little bit worried that somebody is going to commit an act of violence against him. So.
Stefan, never forget that in politics, an assumption of rationality is almost inevitably wrong.
Well, that's true.
So, Dick Mansbach with us, Stefan Schmidt, professors of political science at Iowa State University. Obviously, colleagues for many years. We're enjoying
decades.
Decades. I stand corrected,
yeah,
Stefan and Dick. Yeah. Let's go to our first caller. If you have political words for us, 1-866-780-9100. Talking first of all about the planned Quran burning and the uproar it's caused not only in this country but around the world. 1-866-780-9100. We want to get on to talk about developments in Afghanistan, Iraq, the Middle East, midterm elections as it fits into this as well. But first, let's go to Stephora. Is it Stephora in Iowa City?
Yes, it is.
Hi, Stephora.
Hi.
Great. Welcome to our program. What's on your mind?
Well, thank you for taking my call. The first thing I wanted to say is that I'm a moderate Muslim living in the U.S. And according to me, I don't believe in what all these people in Afghanistan and Iraq are doing, like the terrorists and all that. I mean, that's not what I believe in. And secondly, that if this evangelical priest wants to go ahead and burn the Quran, it has nothing to do with me. I mean, yes, that is the holy book of my religion, but he's just trying to make a stupid statement that he's an illiterate man. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't know nothing about the text and nothing of what the Quran really means. And there's a lot of people in the U.S. that don't know what Islam really means. And if he can go and just go and, get more knowledge about it, he will see that what he's trying to prove is totally wrong.
Stephora, a question for you. To what degree do you think you call yourself a moderate Muslim? To what extent do you believe that you are representative of Muslims in the world? We have this placard in Jakarta today in the news. If the Quran burning takes place, America has failed as a champion of democracy. That's an attitude that is seen in other parts of the world, the most populous Muslim country.
Well, I mean, I'm a moderate Muslim. I do the five pillars of Islam. I mean, I I do that on a daily basis. I pray on a daily basis. I give my alms to the poor. I haven't gone yet to the Hajj. And, I mean, I don't wear the burqa. I don't wear the hijab. I dress moderately. I mean, that's why I feel like I'm a moderate person. And I don't think that people around the world should even consider what he's doing. I mean, this is just publicity stunt. This is for people in the U.S. that is illiterate towards Islam. And, yes, he will attract a lot more people that hate this religion.
Okay.
You know, that feel that this religion is a terrorist religion. That's how I feel.
Dick and Stefan, reaction to Stefora in Iowa City?
I think Stefora is on target. I think what we tend to forget when we discuss Islam is that the most, virtually all victims of Islamic violence are Muslims. And the worst mistake that we can make and that would be reinforced by this kind of lunatic behavior on the part of this pastor, and I use the word with care, is to assume that the world is divided between Muslims and non-Muslims. I think that's a terrible mistake. I think we forget just how many victims today in Iraq or in Afghanistan or in any other country in the world of Islamic violence are, of course, Muslims. What's happening, really, is that there's a civil war to some extent within Islam. We forget on this as 9/11, the anniversary approaches, that probably one of the reasons for the attack on New York and Washington by al-Qaeda was the relative lack of success which Osama bin Laden had been enjoying in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm. Well, to what extent is this also a, you called it a civil war in Islam, but a divide in the United States, a largely Christian country, in what to make about, make of Islam? Our concept of Islam, we don't know how many moderates there are compared to how many radical Muslims there are, do we? That's a question in many people's minds because they don't have Stefora as a neighbor, a moderate Muslim in many cases.
Well, I can tell you from teaching this for God knows 43 years, Americans don't know very much about foreign affairs. It's not just the Middle East, it's Asia, Latin America, wherever else. But I can also tell you on the plus side that recent decades have seen significant increase in young Americans who are studying Arabic, who are paying attention to Islam, who are including it in university and college syllabi. This is really a major change that I've seen. I don't know. I think, Stefan, you probably have seen the same thing.
Yes, I have. And I guess the other sort of half of this is that in Islamic countries, many of the people have no idea, I think, Christian religions are like or what Protestantism is all about. I mean, they also have tremendous misconceptions or sort of abstract and inaccurate views of what these religions are like. And you got to remember that we did have crusades, you know, some time ago. And so there has been a historic precedent for religions essentially imposing themselves on each other in brutal ways. And, you know, religion, if it isn't kept as a kind of personal and sort of moral relationship with a god or gods, can become in the public arena a tremendously powerful and explosive device. So that's why the American Constitution was written the way it was. We try to keep religion in the home and in the heart of people and try to keep it out of the public space. And it has now spilled into the public space.
But this is, of course, in all fairness, one of the difficulties that Americans and Westerners have in dealing with Islam is, of course, this distinction doesn't exist in countries governed by Islamic regimes or theocracies. The distinction between politics and religion, for example, doesn't exist in Iran, which is, as you know, is governed by a group of Islamic thugs.
Well, and in some countries, whether you want to call these moderate Islamic countries or not is up to you, but in Saudi Arabia and in other countries, We do have some real serious issues with the treatment of women and with the treatment of other religious minorities and so on. So, you know, Islam abstractly and the Quran itself may be just another religion, but we have some very significant cultural and moral differences with the practice of it in many, many countries, even if it isn't by radicals.
I agree, but to square the circle, to bring us back to where we began, none of this excuses the kinds of vicious, malicious hatred that is reflected in the bad pastor, not the good pastor.
Yeah, and
the bad pastor,
and also in the opposition to the construction of a Muslim community center near the World Trade Center, which even some Americans who are very open-minded about Islam might find offensive.
We have a tweet on Twitter, the obvious question from this person on Twitter. What would be the reaction if a mosque burned a Bible? Would it be any different?
That's happened, actually. there have been events, the burning of churches especially, for example, in Pakistan is not uncommon.
Okay. Thanks, Stefora. Stefora, thank you for your observations and our conversation. Stefora from Iowa City, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And Jeanette in across the river in Rock Island, Illinois. Good afternoon to you, Jeanette.
Good afternoon. I'm wondering about this. We recognize the harmful consequences of burning the Quran, the harmful consequences to us. But the very act of burning the Quran is actually harming people. Can't that be construed as being a hate crime?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's as offensive as if the Torah were being burned in front of people.
A little comment earlier from Dick and Stefan about the legal implications here once again. Dick, Stefan?
I think one of the problems – I actually agree. I think it is a hate crime. But whether, in fact, it would be legally so described is more dubious because there is no explicit victim who can bring a complaint.
Mm-hmm.
That's the reason why, although I thoroughly agree with the sentiment of our caller, I don't think the laws is actually written more tightly, too tightly, to allow random.
But there hasn't been any crime committed. Nobody has been killed that can be directly traced to the burning of the Quran. It's simply a symbolic act that this pastor is going to commit.
No, but once he commits it. Well, once he commits it, for example, you cannot go into a school and denounce someone in racial or religious terms.
And you can't burn a cross on somebody's front lawn.
That's right. That's
an African American family
exactly.
or something.
Okay,
yeah.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Stefan predicted that this Quran burning will not take place. Dick, do you predict the same?
I have no idea. This man's mind is well beyond my rational capacity to reason it through.
Jeanette, thank you very much for joining us from Rock Island. Before we have to take a break in a few minutes, I wanted to move on, slightly changing gears, to talk about Afghanistan and then Iraq. Let's talk about Afghanistan. The surge of forces ordered last year to Afghanistan by President Barack Obama are now in place. General David Petraeus, anticipating sustained violence in Afghanistan in the coming months, says he wants to overhaul how the U.S. measures progress there, leading to a crucial Obama administration war strategy review coming in December. The counterinsurgency campaign being waged by NATO forces in Afghanistan is focusing on lessening violence, restoring confidence in President Hamid Karzai's government. General Petraeus drew comparisons between the current situation in Afghanistan, the situation in Iraq a few months after the 2007 surge. You remember this began there before the violence began to decline. Let's look at this parallel. To what degree are we going to see a parallel experience in Afghanistan that we had in Iraq, lessening of violence, things seeming to stabilize after a surge?
I'm glad you asked nice, simple questions. this is certainly easy. We actually have talked about this. We talk about this every day.
Yeah.
I think the comparison is fallacious. But it also includes certain premises. One premise is that we've actually succeeded in Iraq, and therefore the question is, are we going to succeed in Afghanistan as we have in Iraq? I am not at all convinced as I sit here that we have succeeded in Iraq, all right? I wouldn't be the slightest bit surprised, given the fact that it's now been March since a government has not existed, that this almost failed state of Iraq becomes, in fact, a definitive failed state, by which time we will be out and have washed our hands largely of the problem. I'm not saying that will happen, but it's entirely probable given, shall we say, Iraqi politics. Furthermore, Afghanistan is simply a very different kind of country. It's not. This is not urban warfare. This is not. This is a huge place that, on three occasions the British tried to pacify unsuccessfully, and in some cases extremely unsuccessfully. That Russia tried to pacify, actually using tactics that we emulated at least initially. I know this is sort of post hoc, but had the Petraeus policy been followed in Afghanistan, starting in 2001, I would have been a much happier person. So I'm not sure it's salvageable, but I do have one alternative that I think people ought to be thinking about. If it is in fact not salvageable, despite how terrific a politician General Petraeus is, we really can consider the idea that Afghanistan's neighbors may have a real interest in filling any vacuum that we might leave. Its neighbors are Iran, Russia, Pakistan, and indirectly and importantly, India and China. And in many respects, their stake in Afghanistan is far greater than ours. We're there because of 9/11. But in a very real sense, what happens there is likely to affect us far less than it will that country's immediate neighbors.
Stefan Schmidt, we have a couple minutes before we have to break. Your take on this.
Well, and the analysis that keeps coming out, in whether it's in leaks or whether it's in actual government sort of reports, is that the actual large presence of foreign troops in Afghanistan, to some extent, drives people to the insurgency or various different insurgencies, and it's a country that is dominated by family and by village and by clan and by all kinds of associations that are not the national government. And so to build up a national government in Kabul is in many ways one part of stabilizing Afghanistan. But people out in the northern provinces and in Pashtun areas, and so they don't care about Kabul. It's never been much part of their lives. Mm-hmm. They control the drug trafficking and the local community activities and smuggling and arms dealing and getting bribed by the Pakistani intelligence services. And that's their life. And the central government is sort of a remote and rather meaningless thing. So we're going to have a very tough time, I think, using military force, forcing the Afghans somehow to behave themselves and lay down their weapons. And I agree with my colleague, Professor Mansbach, that there are regional players, and it is eventually going to be those players who are going to have to fill the vacuum. I think we can do what we did in Iraq and at some point sort of arbitrarily look for some metrics that say that the level of violence has gone down and say, we've gotten there, now we're going to start essentially turning this over to the Afghans, the Pakistanis, the Iranian mm-hmm. intelligence services, and whoever else wants to play, and we're going to come home because we can't stay there forever.
We have to take a short break. Professor Stefan Schmidt, thank you. Dick Mansbach, Professor Mansbach, please stand by as we take a short break and come back to continue our discussion about the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq, the political implications there, also new peace negotiations in the Middle East. What are your feelings as we look at this pre-anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, look at the wars in Afghanistan, Iraq? 1-866-780-9100. How do you feel now that the war in Afghanistan is moving along with a surge by President Obama? 1-866-780-9100. We'll be back in a few minutes. And we're back with The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us over the noon hour. Tomorrow at this time, we're marking National Suicide Prevention Week. The conversation about suicide prevention tomorrow, efforts in Iowa against suicide. And we'll talk with the brother of someone who took his life in 2007, find out how he's coping. Also a partnership between Johnson County and the University of Iowa offering free suicide prevention courses. That's the topic of our discussion tomorrow, Thursday, here on The Exchange over the noon hour. Today, it's Politics Day. It's Wednesday. This hour, we're focusing mainly on the political implications of our wars in Iraq and Afghanistan as we prepare to mark the anniversary of the 9/11 attacks this Saturday. Also, the uproar in the news over the planned burning of Korans in Florida. New peace efforts in the Middle East. Midterm elections all weaving into that discussion as well. We'd like your opinion in this second half hour. 1-866-780-9100 or the exchange at iowapublicradio.org, our email. Great to have with us political science professors Stefan Schmidt and Dick Monsbach of Iowa State University in our studios in Ames. And gentlemen, you're still there?
We are.
Are you ready to take some calls? Let's go first to Larry in Cedar Falls. Larry, good afternoon. What's on your mind?
Thanks for the good program. Recently, President Obama commented after the ground forces or the armed conflict guys were taken out of Iraq that he hoped Iraq would be a good partner in the future. And it symbolized to me that the West has chosen or found it necessary to force our way of life, our institutions and economics on Muslim nations with a lot of loss of life and infrastructure. And were there any realistic alternatives to this path we're on?
You want to do sort of a what if, a toss a what if to Dick and Stefan?
Well, that's actually a terrific question because what your caller is describing is exactly what the Bush administration believed. The Bush administration, the neocons as they were called, believed what some political scientists have said to them, that democracies are less likely to fight wars than autocracies. They then reasoned that if you therefore spread democracy, you would spread with it peace. And indeed, you may recall that Iraq was cited as actually a connection with the Arab-Israeli conflict and that this would be the direction in which one could resolve that conflict. That hypothesis, I think, is wrong. I think, in all fairness to the Obama administration, for all its, shall we say, to-ings and fro-ings, I don't think the Obama administration believes this one whit. And I think that the policy to date has been to retreat away from this particular goal, in whether it involves Egypt, whether it involves Syria, whether it involves others who, by the way, are governed by individuals who are just as nasty as Saddam Hussein ever was. Was there an alternative? Oh, absolutely. As a matter of fact, Professor Schmidt and I were discussing it just before the program. We had a brute governing Iraq, but he was our brute. He was no more brutish than most of the other leaders in the region. He had balanced militarily Iran. We had, in fact, tilted towards him in one of the bloodiest wars since World War II, the Iranian-Iraqi War that raged through much of the 1980s. We had succeeded in curtailing his imperial ambitions in the first Persian Gulf War. And as it turns out, and as we should have recognized, we had also succeeded in curtailing his nuclear ambitions. The search, as you know, still goes on for the imaginary nuclear weapons that he was supposed to have. So, I would argue that the ideology of spreading democracy to make the world safe for America or whomever, it no longer governs Washington's policy. And yes, B, I think we had a real alternative to the action that the Bush administration took in 2003.
Let's go from where we are now and talk about what could possibly happen. In Baghdad, we know a resolution to the impasse over the formation of an Iraqi government appears as distant as ever. Politicians fighting over top positions, the public impatience there. There's some disillusionment with Iraq's democratic experiment. So this comes 6 months after an election in Iraq produced no clear winner, has pitted the Sunni-backed alliance against the country's mainly Shiite-led factions. What are the possible scenarios as we look into the future, not what might have been, but what could be in the future given what we have today? How might this be resolved?
Well, I mean, we have an assumption in all of this that elections work everywhere and that you can therefore create governments through elections. And that's a totally rebuttable presumption. I mean, elections in liberal democracy are the product of hundreds and hundreds of years of social, economic, religious, and other developments, which finally produce a condition where you can have this kind of stuff happen. And that's why it's so rare around the world, not just in these places we're talking about. What can happen in Iraq is that the place can become a sort of confederation, somehow loosely tied together, in which the different regions are really dominated by the religious and clan groups that control those parts of Iraq and that have historical roots there and have their own trade relationships and familial relationships and so on, and that it won't look anything like a liberal democracy. Number two, you can have a new Saddam Hussein sort of crawl out of the woodwork somewhere and reunite the country and beat back the different groups back into their boxes, so to speak, the way Saddam Hussein did. And, you know, he was a terrible dictator and a lot of people suffered. But I think more people have died and are suffering since the liberation of Iraq, you know, with the American invasion and so on, than in many of the decades of his rule. So the least likely scenario is that they're going to pull together some sort of government that is fairly liberal and that is a coalition of these various forces, and that they'll kind of get along with each other and stabilize the country. I mean, I just personally don't think that's very much in the political and cultural DNA of the country.
One other scenario, of course, and that is that either part or all of the country becomes an Iranian province.
So we're looking at the reason going into Iraq was to make us here in North America safer, primarily. Doesn't sound like we may be any safer when I listen to your prognostications there.
I think less safe. I think considerably less safe for a whole variety of reasons, not least of which is that what we were talking about earlier on the program, the alienation of increasing numbers of Muslims, the fact that we ignored during this entire period of time, literally ignored the Israeli-Palestinian affair, the fact that it has allowed Iran to become a significantly larger threat than it ever would have been had the invasion never taken place, and has also succeeded in alienating friendly countries such as Turkey in the process. And finally, the fact that one of the reasons we're up to our earlobes in Afghanistan is that, too, was largely ignored because of the almost monomaniacal preoccupation of the previous administration with Baghdad.
If you've just joined us, professors of political science at Iowa State University joining us this hour, Dick Monsbach and Stefan Schmidt. If you'd like to join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Our email, gentlemen, the hour is getting away from us as it does so often. Let's go back to the phones. Jeff is in Cedar Rapids. Good afternoon, Jeff. Thank you for waiting.
Oh, well, thank you for taking my call. I'd just like to comment that here in my neighborhood in Cedar Rapids, the Mother Mosque is only about 3-4 blocks away from me. We've always got along with the Muslims. The fact is, I wouldn't even know that they were or weren't if they didn't tell me.
Mm-hmm. In fact, we had the imam of the Mother Mosque on this program just a few days ago. Go ahead. He expressed the same sort of harmony with the Cedar Rapids community and the mosque.
Absolutely. And I had the good fortune of listening to the program as well. But I would like to comment as far as the pastor down in Florida is concerned, and he wants to burn the Quran and do all these bad things. Well, I believe I'm going to take this opportunity and ask permission from their mosque if I may purchase a Quran, and I will put it in my house. And I urge all the listeners to do the same, so that for every holy book of the Islam that is burned, that 10 are purchased.
Well, there you go.
I'm a Catholic myself.
And then make sure that the people in the Middle East know about it, because they're going to get a lot of coverage on the minister burning these at 9/11.
Right, Jeff. Yes. Jeff, but you, as a Catholic, your Quran buying instead of burning will not be covered by any of the Taliban or Al Qaeda websites, right?
No, no, I'm just a carpenter from Cedar Rapids, you know. I have no intentions on doing anything on a global effort.
Well, it's a statement. Thank you for your opinion and your plans for a counter-protest. Jeff in Cedar Rapids, thank you very much. Since Dick, you mentioned this before, the Middle East peace talks beginning this month in Washington. At the beginning, glimmers of optimism and excitement over this renewed discourse between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. No direct talks in almost 2 years. Now the outlook is grim. We've got all these factors going in, the likely resumption of Jewish settlement, lack of popular Palestinian approval for the peace talks, also this looming possibility of an Israeli strike on Iran. So how is this wise diplomacy for President Obama in advance of the midterm elections while this country is still in the doldrums? And that seems to be what matters most to the voters, to pursue Mideast peace once again.
Well, if I were a pessimist, I would say these talks first began when Moses conferred with Pharaoh. But in reality, I'm a little more optimistic. The election is not going to be determined by the success or failure of the Middle East peace talks. It's as Bill Clinton said, it's the economy, stupid. There's no question that's what the determinant's going to be, in my judgment, in the election. I think that the administration and I think the Secretary of State in particular feel this is among the two or three most important issues, most decisive issues in the world. You take it when you can get it. There's one particular action that the current Israeli government could take that I think could change the entire appearance of the issue, and that would be a change in which the radical right-wing members of the Israeli coalition government were essentially tossed out in exchange for the third party that has been excluded, the middle-of-the-road party, that Kadima, that's been excluded from the coalition. This has been suggested over and over again, and if I can just speculate, one wonders if there haven't been discussions about this possibility with the Israeli Prime Minister in Washington.
Mm-hmm. There may be something we don't know.
It would be an enormously bold step on his part. And I think if something like that were to happen, the resulting coalition would be probably more capable of a compromise than any previous Israeli coalition. I can't imagine that Abbas, the PLO leader, entered those talks without at least some kind of guarantee, something. If not, then he should never have sat down.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't the Obama administration up to this point also receiving some criticism about its lack of initiative in the Middle East, and perhaps that's the reason for doing this as well?
Well, there hasn't been one. I mean, you know, George Mitchell has got more miles, free miles, than any other diplomat in recent history. If there's been criticism, it's been unjustified. Whatever flaws may exist in that foreign policy, complacency regarding the Israeli-Palestinian question isn't one of them.
Mm-hmm. What has changed in the Middle East to make us believe chances are better for this time around in peace initiative?
You know, I'm not sure that we're convinced the chances are better. I think conditions have gotten worse, and therefore the need for some kind of solution has become more and more pressing. I mean, you know, that's a really rough neighborhood. I don't know if you've remembered my favorite film, Casablanca, but you have Humphrey Bogart telling the Nazi, if you invade the United States, don't come to New York because there are areas you wouldn't survive in. Well, the New York of Humphrey Bogart is the Middle East. I mean, to the north of Israel are the thugs of Hezbollah. To the south of Israel are the thugs of Hamas. The strings are being pulled from Tehran. Things can only get worse for everybody who is involved in these talks. And I think there's some recognition of this. There's certainly recognition of this on the part of other Arab countries in the region, the Saudis, the Egyptians, the Jordanians. Maybe it won't work. But I think everybody knows what a solution would look like. We really do. The problem is how to get there and to find the language which will, in fact, cover the discrepancies in the negotiating positions, and B,
somehow dealing with domestic Israeli and Palestinian politics.
Mm-hmm. We have just a few minutes left with our professors of political science from Iowa State University on this Politics Day here on The Exchange, Dick Mansbach and Stefan Schmidt. And we want to reach out to our listeners one more time before the hour ends, or focusing mainly on the political implications of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan as we mark this anniversary of 9/11. What's on your political mind as we come up to Saturday's anniversary of the attacks of 9/11? And before we do finish up for this hour, the callers 1-866-780-9100 or the exchange at iowapublicradio.org. Wanted to talk specifically about the midterm elections, even though we have mentioned that we have a combination of a sky-high GOP with its enthusiasm, a deep sense of pessimism about the country's direction, and a dissatisfaction with President Obama's stewardship of the economy. That's given the Republicans a clear advantage heading into the November elections, according to the latest NBC News Wall Street Journal poll. Republicans, a 9-point edge among those considered likely voters, a near 20-point lead among those expressing the highest amount of interest in the midterms. 6 in 10 believe the country is on the wrong track. Gentlemen, what do you make of these and other poll numbers that don't look so good for the Democrats? How can the GOP capitalize on these poll numbers?
They just have to show up at the polling places, which they appear to be on the way to doing, and the Democrats will have a tremendous setback, partly because the last couple of years they engaged in the most ignorant and unsuccessful politics I've ever seen in my life. They inherited, you know, all of these disasters that were basically the 8 years of Bush and Cheney, deregulation, Wall Street going down the toilet, like wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, unsuccessful wars, enormous numbers of casualties and everything else. And how did they decide to play this when Obama won? Bipartisanship, never mentioning the Republicans and reaching across the aisle to the GOP in the House and Senate.
But Obama was elected with the charge to have us work together in the United States
so.
And not divide
I
us, wasn't
think,
he? He's
I
doing
think,
what he was elected for.
I think
for.
That is an absolute misreading, and history will show that he was elected because people were incredibly sick of the 8 years of Bush and of Cheney and of conservative Republicans and wanted to give the Democrats a chance to reverse all of that and, in fact, to point out who had caused these problems. I think, the people who voted for Obama were not voting, for bipartisanship and for a coalition government. This is the United States. In the United States, when you win an election, you have been given a mandate, and the mandate is that you are to pursue the policies that the voters asked you to pursue, and you are to basically go after your opponents and pulverize them. And I think what happened was that, you know, in being conciliatory, at least President Obama himself basically lost his base, which is completely unmobilized. And one of the problems is going to be that Democrats are just not going to go vote, or they're going to vote Republican.
Professor Mansbach, you have something to add.
We're going to have a coalition government, of course. The House is almost certain to be a Republican. The Senate is going to be close enough so that it really doesn't matter who's in the majority. And I think we can recall the last time this happened, they turned out to be the best years of the Clinton administration.
So it doesn't necessarily mean an unproductive Congress.
No, it doesn't at all. But you have to have the political skills of a Bill Clinton, and you have to be prepared to appoint Nancy Pelosi ambassador to Iraq. I mean, I'm not sure that, to my surprise, the administration really knows how to play the game.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because a lot of these are former Clintonites.
We have just a minute or two left. What are the key strategies for each party would you recommend between now and November for the Democrats to do some damage control and for the GOP to capitalize in a big way?
The GOP has the magic formula. They've managed with their resistance to anything that Obama and the Congress, the Democrats and the Congress want to do to get this enormous gap between themselves and this enormous lead. And I think the Democrats, the best thing they can do is run away from Obama and run to their local district and try and sell themselves for the both House and Senate, if they're running for the Senate, in terms of what they have done and can do for their district and their state. and run a campaign that is very provincial, that is very local, that really moves away from all of the big national issues that Obama forced onto the Congress and that were important issues, but that created such a panic among Americans, mm-hmm. and that includes health care reform and all those other things, that they probably can't win on those issues, but they might be able to do a little bit better running locally on local issues.
Professor Monsbach, 30 seconds
agree.
For you.
I don't agree. I think the economy. The problem with Obama was health care rather than the economy. I think next 2 years from now, with a Republican Congress, the economy is still going to be an issue, except the Republican Congress is going to be part of that issue.
Okay. Very good. We have to go away now. Professors Dick Monsbach and Stefan Schmidt of Iowa State University, it's been a great pleasure to have you as a tandem in our studios in Ames. Thank you very much, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistance today from Lindsay Moon. Technical support from Dennis Reese. In Ames, we had help from Michael Yeager. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows is Jeff Schmidt. Podcasting and on-demand audio of all of our shows available at iowapublicradio.org. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. Thanks for all the calls and emails today. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Please tune in again tomorrow.